This is a short edit of my chat with Justin. If you want to hear an extra 15 minutes, mainly covering their SDLC, check out my webpage, nodogmapodcast.brianhogan.net.
This is a No Dogma Podcast. I'm Brian Hogan, and today I'm at the YesWare offices in downtown Boston, joined by software engineer Justin Mills. Thanks for joining me, Justin.
Welcome. It's a pleasure.
Can you tell me a little bit about yourself and what you do here?
Okay, yeah. So my title here at YesWare is engineer. We're a fairly flat organization, so there's not a lot of titles amongst the development staff. I've been at YesWare a little over 2 years. And prior to YesWare, I've worked at a couple other smaller companies in the Boston area, and been doing software development since the late 90s, and spanning all over the place, from server-side code, client-side code, but more recently finding my niche on the server side, trying to deal more with big data problems and getting insights out of the data.
And then what does YesWare do?
So YesWare is a sales acceleration tool. We're in the space of enabling salespeople to do their jobs better. And a lot of what that has to do with is making connections with people, establishing trust with them, selling their products, obviously. We try to make a lot of the day-to-day aspects of being a salesperson that are a grind and not really fun automated for them. So we do a lot of integration with Salesforce, a lot of reporting. We're primarily an email tool. And so we have an Outlook product, an iOS product, and a Gmail plugin that really we are focusing at this point on delivering value with the emphasis on email right now. So
where does big data come into this?
So a lot of what we are doing is a lot of our value is provided by tracking the interactions that salespeople are having with the people they're prospecting into. So a lot of times you'll have a salesperson whose role is to basically make first contact. You're trying to set up a meeting with someone and just get someone interested, figure out who's interested and who's not. And so you wind up sending many emails. We provide a lot of tracking information along with that email, so the ability to see when someone opens it, if you have links in the email, are they clicking. Also allow the ability to track file downloads and presentations and things of that nature. So that generates winds up generating a lot of data that we can then turn around and say and help the user do their job better by trying to give them insights into what's effective, what's working, what's not, who's opening your emails, who are not, who are clicking links, things like that. So
better targeting then after you gather more data.
Yeah, basically. It's about honing in on what works, what doesn't, and so yeah.
So a few weeks ago, I met yourself at a presentation where you were presenting, I think it was StackDive?
Yeah, it was the StackDive.
StackDive Boston, a very interesting group where a company will go into depth on a particular aspect of their work, technical or non. And your presentation was primarily about how you develop here at YesWare. Can you give a quick overview of that?
Sure, yeah. So, like I said, our development is pretty, organization is pretty flat. We try to, I emphasize this in the talk I gave, where we tend to hire what we call T-shaped people. I think that's probably very common around, where we like full stack people who can do a lot of different things, generally have a specialty in one thing. And so the process, what we like to do is free up the team so that the team can deliver the entire feature. So if product comes to us and says, we need to develop this new tracking feature or this new extension onto Outlook, the idea is that the team is unencumbered by anything between the product owner making the request and getting it out to customers' hands. And so the development team will typically take that set of requirements, return with an estimate to the product owner. After there's some agreement on that, development begins. The team would then take that on through the testing phase. We do very rigorous code reviews of of every change that's made. Not to say that every code review is a rigorous, in-depth thing. It's just that we do code reviews of everything. So even a typo gets code reviewed. So it's, some of them are easier, some of them are more involved. But it's sort of like take that process all the way through, and then you get to the team would then also be responsible for deploying the code into production and monitoring it as well.
It's kind of like a DevOps approach to some degree.
Yeah, to some degree, yeah. We have no ops team. We have no special, and this came up, I think, in the talk as well, where we don't really have, we have specialists, but that's not their job. Like, we have people who are really good at test and people who know operations stuff and who can do performance engineering, but that's not their job. Their job is still to deliver features and products enhancements to the product. So they're spending the majority of their time building new features and new functionality. We may lean on these people from time to time when it turns out that we're having a performance problem. We need to get some expertise. But really, it's very much encouraged that everyone take part in all of these aspects of the development cycle.
So when a product owner comes to your team, there isn't as such a team lead or anything like that?
No. So oftentimes what will happen is there's sort of, it will sort of happen naturally. So there might not be a team lead, but generally someone will step up and sort of take that role. It's never really formal. But oftentimes, in the normal process of taking a set of requirements and turning it into something, oftentimes it just works best if someone goes and thinks about it for a little bit and comes up with an idea or a proposal so that other people, like a straw man, so you can start chipping away at it, see what works, what doesn't. So that's typically how we've done things, and it works out great. There's obviously like some downsides to that longer term. We wind up with an architecture that's not necessarily cohesive across everything. But I also think it's also very empowering to everyone, to where you don't show up for work and you're being given a set of features that you have to work on, which you may have little input into which ones you get to work on, but also have also no control over how you're implementing it.
You were saying, though, that a product owner will come to the team and somebody will select themselves to go off and kind of be the de facto lead for that period. Does that tend to be the same person repeatedly, or does it get divided up somehow?
I can't say too much. I think it kind of depends on what the ask is. To some extent, it's where your interest lies. So I don't know that we've ever had a case where we've had too many people like trying to design the same thing or too few, no one willing to step up.
How do you deal, though? You said that you don't have a cohesive architecture, but how do you communicate between multiple teams if there's going to be some infrastructure component built, for example?
The communication between teams, so we're all try to communicate with each other as much as we can, but it winds up not being a ton because we're primarily working on isolated features. And I think that some of that is done where we try to get a little bit ahead of it on the product side of things when we're planning out features and which teams might take which feature. Try to get a little ahead to where there's not going to be a lot of overlap. So if a team needs to go enhance some aspect of our calendar syncing ability, we probably shouldn't put two different teams working on that because they're just going to start colliding, or having two teams build something around a shared service. We should probably, so we do try to get ahead of those things a little bit.
But who tries to get ahead of them, though? Again, because if you don't have this hierarchy, so that's, whose role
that's,
is it?
Yeah, that's where it gets a little tricky, I think. So in the past, it has largely been sort of at the executive level, to where when the executives were deciding the roadmap for the quarter, there's technical representatives. The VP of engineering was there, the CTO was there, and they were primarily coders and I think still are to a decreasing amount, but still have their hands in the code a little bit. So they're familiar with things and teams that are individuals that have specialties. So they're trying to get ahead of it. I think other than that, there's a lot of sort of ad hoc discussions. The teams are made aware of things as far in advance as they can. And, you know, always with the caveat of like, don't let this burden you because we're not going to work on it for 2 or 3 months, but just start thinking about this type of thing. And so that winds up brewing sort of informal discussions and, you know, groups of people will form and just go off into a room to talk about how might we do this? Like, what would be the ideal way? And is there something we should do now to get ahead of it? To date, all that has worked. We've been a pretty small organization. And, you know, with 20 developers, that's not a daunting task. I think that as we get bigger, that's going to be a very interesting space for us to have to deal with. Because I don't think when we're 50 people, it's going to work as well.
No, I imagine it's particularly on infrastructure and shared components. And you're bound to have multiple teams who need to, let's say, change a database schema at the same time or work on some performance issue or a caching issue.
Yeah, and we've dealt with a lot of those issues. And very luckily, I think, to date, as sort of one-off issues, you know, we've handled a lot of sort of like the classic schema migrations and data migration problems by splitting up our architecture into smaller apps. So database migrations happen quite frequently, and they're not very, we've sort of got a pattern for how we do them, and they're well understood. We've designed the system around those that being known as a problem, but yeah, I think there will come a day where we will need
a little hierarchy,
a little, yeah, we'll need someone to go out and sort of blaze a trail and say, we're going to replace, like, you know, one of the things that I mentioned in the stack dive is we have a lot of queues. We have a lot of queuing systems. Some of them are sort of like you're sort of one level up from Ruby and Rails 101 queuing things to now we're mostly using Rabbit. But in the time, in the last week and a half, we found a great reason that we're going to not be able to use Rabbit in the future. And so, you know, so someone's, and that's going to be a non-trivial thing to find what works where Rabbit did not, or to build something around Rabbit. And so, yeah, when some of those bigger problems come up, it will definitely be a challenge. I can say in the past, the way we've dealt with some of our, what I guess I would call like bigger infrastructure issues is to form a special team to do it. And so about a year and a half ago, pretty shortly after I started, our primary benefit that we provide people is tracking information. And so we have a whole entire tracking pipeline of things that happen. And it would fall behind a little bit during the day. And people, you know, get a little annoyed, 5 minutes behind, 10 minutes. And then routinely it was falling 4 hours behind every day. And this was clearly something we could not have. And there was no easy solution. We tried many of them. And so at the end of the of that whole analysis period where we all just sort of got in a room and said, someone's going to have to fix this, and it's not going to be fast, and it's going to take a while, and at the end of the day, you're not going to have a new feature. You're going to have the same thing. It's just going to work, and it's going to hopefully work by 2 years.
In order to get the time to do that, you had to take 3 or 4 people away from existing teams, existing projects. Did you have to get buy-in from someone or approval from someone for this?
So I think in that case, that one was maybe a little easy because that was something that was very visible all the way up. The CEO was in the chat room that we were saying, sorry, tracking's 4 hours behind. And he was like, I'm giving demos now. I can't have it be 4 hours behind. So that one benefited from being a highly, highly visible thing. Sort of more recently, one of the other things that we replaced was our IMAP system. This is the system that connects to your Gmail mailbox through IMAP. And that one was a little harder. That one was a little harder sell because the old system worked. It was okay. It was clunky. It was falling behind like everything else. It wasn't terrible, but it was a little harder sell to see why it was so bad off, and it was a little hard to see what the benefits you got on the other end. There was a plan for a whole quarter's worth of work to deliver a feature off of that. And so the whole idea is that, well, we'll get all this goodness in about 2.5 months, and we'll spend 2 weeks throwing together a feature on the end of it, which will appease sort of our internal desire to have features. And we made it close. We got to the 2-month mark before it got, the plug got pulled on it. But, you know, we got the majority of the benefit of the thing, of the system. And so that one was a tough negotiation. And I think the lesson learned from that is that we have to be very careful of these big pieces of infrastructure that we bite off. And we really need to fit them into very small time windows with very small teams, which I realize sounds sort of like an impossible thing. And so I think the reality of that is we will be doing smaller of those things, and we will be doing more of waiting for something that we can't avoid and then fixing it.
How do teams get assigned to the various projects that need to be done?
So Yesware has experimented with that thing, that idea, we've had a couple of iterations. It's in the time that I've been in here. Right now, the way it works is a lot closer to the way it worked when I first started, which was the execs come up with a priority list of what they want to work on and sort of an estimated weight. They through their sort of some higher level estimations, figure out how much fits on a team and then assign a team. That part process is sort of all done sort of at the same time. So the Outlook team's not going to get assigned a Gmail task or ask, for instance. And so right now we're sort of back into that sort of idea of how to take what the execs and the product team want and turn that into teams actually working on it. The other idea that we tried in the past is a little bit more of a free-for-all. That's kind of how I always thought of it, which is more of a, like a marketplace of engineers on one hand, and on the other hand, you had ideas and feature requests. And so if you wanted to get your feature worked on, then you would try to find an engineer or a group of engineers that would work on it for you.
And the person looking would be the likes of a product owner?
It could be a product owner. It could be a salesperson saying, if you give this to me, I will be able to close 4 more deals or this much more money in MRR, which is a metric that we're trying to measure what was worth it and what wasn't worth it, because you want something is not a really great reason. So we would try to boil economics down to it, to where how much money can we make on the feature? How much does it cost? The idea was that if you could come and show that you could earn your worth in monthly recurring revenue, that you could go work on it. If you needed a team of 4 to do that, you would try to find your team of 4. If you were an engineer on a team and you didn't want to work on what you were working on, you wanted to go jump over to this other project, you could do that. And so it sounds kind of like the Wild West, where you're sort of like going out there and everyone's just working on what they want. But it didn't wind up being that way. People wound up forming small teams and of like 3 to 4 people and largely working on what you would walk in and you would think it was like a traditional agile organization. The product team sort of went around, decided what they wanted to work on. The teams were working on very cohesive things that made sense. But the idea was that if you wanted to hop off and do something else on another team, you could do that.
So is this what's called open allocation?
I think I'm not familiar with that, but basically it was the encouragement that the development organization, the developers were not tied to product people through teams in any way. You had to still prove your worth as an engineer. So you couldn't just go do whatever you wanted. But if you could prove that you were delivering value, you could work on whatever you wanted to deliver value.
Have you moved away from that model to a large degree now? Because it sounded like you've got an Outlook team and a Gmail team something else.
So we tried that, and I want to say we started that in the beginning of January, and the whole, that was...
January this year?
This year, yeah.
How old is the company again?
So I joined a little over 2 years, and I think at that point it was a little over 2 years, so we're about, maybe we're approaching the 5-year mark, I think.
Okay, so that's, a fairly mature-ish company.
Yeah, I mean, Not a 6 month out of the gate. We're just
No, it's not like your first thing that you're ever going to do.
Yeah, okay. So yeah, we moved away from it, and I think the real problem with it was, and I can imagine this from the execs level, they had no idea what was going on. I mean, I think at one point there was six teams, which from an engineering perspective was great because there was a two-person team, some three-people teams, some four-people teams, sort of like the nice unit of engineers to get something pretty good done, but not so big that you've got all the overhead of having an eight-person stand-up. But, you know, at the execs level, they just wanted to see that the roadmap's being hit. And so it was a lot of that, and it was not being distilled through any layers. We started seeing that it was going to be hard to get some of our bigger milestones. And there was even a little bit of sort of forcing of the tipping the scales, you know, this idea of, well, you can pick whatever you want to work on, but someone's got to work on this. You know, we have customer commitments.
There's
we have
money.
Deadlines. Yeah. The product team, was wanting to start to tackle some bigger pieces of functionality that were not going to be doable by a three-person team in 2 weeks.
So how long did this experiment started in January, went on until?
I would say we really didn't get started in it, honestly, until probably beginning of February. There was a lot of planning and discussions and prep. And January was a sort of a transition time. So grand total, I would say maybe 2 months. So not a terribly long time, but...
So who pulled the plug?
From my understanding, it was the management team. I don't know.
So that's VP of Engineering, CTO, CEO.
Yeah. Somewhere in there, there was a change. In fact, the week of Stack Dive, we had had a small layoff that week to reshuffle the organization, development organization. I think from that perspective, it was more of a, let's refocus. Let's go back to an approach that's a lot closer, resembles the way we used to. Product and exec team hands down the direction they want to go, the features they want to go. Teams are assigned that primarily at a pretty high level. We're starting to experiment with some things. I was in a design session with the CEO, CTO, VP of marketing and some designers to kind of set the quarter roadmap. And so I think that we're trying to bring more engineers into those types of meetings so we have more visibility and more input into what's going on. And, because to raise issues, things like, you think that's easy, but there's this roadblock in the middle it's going to be one of those 3 month infrastructure things that no one's going to like. So maybe, what do we do about that?
So would it tend to be the more experienced engineers that are brought in?
So we've only had one. And so, so far, and my guess would be that we might rotate other people. I don't really know. I don't know if there is if this is the move of a shift in sort of engineering culture, if you will.
Yeah, it does seem to lend itself to that direction, because if you're going to have engineers coming into those meetings, you want to bring people in who are knowledgeable and competent, which is effectively meaning the more elevated, not using that term in a fancy sense, but the higher up, the more senior.
So there have been no moves from the management team so far to impose any kind of hierarchy. I don't know how that would really go over. I know that like in the early days we talked about it, and there's like also the problem with being a startup is with titles and positions is you're so small.
Yes.
You hire
Everyone's
someone.
Everyone's oppressed.
Yeah. You hire someone and you
chief
give someone
this,
with
chief
like,
that.
Yeah. Yeah. So titles, I think we've sort of avoided those. If you need a title, then at this point, maybe it's not a right fit. You can have all the responsibilities a lot of those roles. But you might not get the title or the mandate that you kind of want.
What I found though in companies is that sometimes titles get in the way because people are fighting over them, but sometimes they're very useful simply because you're known as the go-to person because you are the senior or you're the architect or you're the lead. But it also gives you the ability to negotiate, for example, with the product team. if the product team comes, for example, to you as an engineer and they don't get the answer they want, they can just go to the next engineer because you're the same.
Yeah. I think that, so that is one thing that I will happily say that we've never had here. I think we benefit from being small. So it's very easy because you walk out there and you ask everyone, like, who knows more about this? Oh, that's Dave. Oh, who knows more about this? That's Justin. It's sort of like the product team is not going to second guess that. They might shop around the idea to get a few alternative proposals and then, but it's always come back around. It's always come back around to say, hey, I know you said this was this, but talking to so-and-so, what if we did it a little different? And then you think about it more. You're like, oh, okay, yeah, maybe I can get that to work.
Outside of your development organization, are there titles? Are there roles?
Yes, we do have some in the sales and business development.
So they have managers or seniors or something. Is there something to suggest seniority?
I'm actually not sure of. I don't know that I've actually looked into it. There are definitely role titles. So within sales, we have a BDR, business development representative, I think, role. But that is a little bit more, I think, role specific.
So one of the things at the at your StackDive presentation that I found maybe worrying is the term. You'd mentioned a technology choice and there had been trouble with it for about 18 months. But there wasn't really anyone in a position to say, screw it, enough of this, we're dropping it. It's cost us enough, let's move on. And I felt, without obviously knowing your company, I felt that if there had been someone in a position who could say that and take the responsibility, you might have been better off.
Yeah, so I think the thing you're referring to there is the decision to stay on Heroku versus abandon them when things started getting really bad. To be fair, things never got really, really bad. They were very annoying. There were a lot of problems, but it was never to the point where it was painstaking clear. And I think that was really the problem. And yes, I do agree that had there been someone who had that role, that we would have either said, nope, we're going all in and we're going to get happy on it, not in 18 months, in 1 month, or we're going to spend the next 3 months getting off Heroku and on Amazon. I think honestly, that was a little bit more of a fault of the engineers as opposed to not having that person. Because if I had come and said, I'll do this, I can get us off, I can get our first application off in like a month, and we'll get the second one in another month, and then they'll all just fall. I'm pretty sure that they would have approved it and said, okay, let's do it. And at the time, there was no love for Heroku, so it would not have taken much. It wouldn't have been a hard sell. You wouldn't have had to gone off and do benchmarking or research or any of that. You could have just said, I'll own this project.
But that's, again, that's coming back to the responsibility, isn't it?
Yeah. So there's not a person who's where it's that person's job to make the decision, stick with Heroku or leave, but.
Or any, let's say, large decision because you're flat. No one gets to say.
Yeah.
So and that would affect multiple teams, of course.
Yeah. I think that had any one person stepped up, we would have taken them very seriously about it. But at the time, it was also unclear to me whether there was real, buy-in across the development organization for it, or whether it was really going to be worthwhile.
During the presentation, again, at StackDive, and you've mentioned it yourself, that you use AnyJob, I got the feeling that there was a pretty large degree of unhappiness with the AnyJob process in Yesware.
Yeah. So at this point, one of the things that changed was it wasn't completely abandoning Agile, but it was largely switching to a Kanban style of development. I think a few of the teams during the 2 month experiment, period had really great success with Kanban. And so they had switched, during that period, cause part of the rules for that period was there are no rules. There was like basically three engineering rules. Which were things like, you know, if you get paged, you have to actually work on it. And, you know, things have to work. But they were pretty high level. And so if you didn't want to do Scrum, you didn't have to. And there were several teams that didn't. And so we've mostly switched to Kanban. And the teams are all doing sort of variations of that now. And I think most of the teams are fairly happy with it. The team that I joined was probably the exception to the to everything. They were very happy with Scrum. They didn't mind the ceremonies. They didn't mind all of the estimating, any of those types of things. The rituals of retrospectives, of presenting when you're done and giving estimates and story points. So that team actually had a very tough time. We had a very tough time starting off this process. But yeah, there was a lot of struggle in the early days. And now we've settled on a process that it looks like Kanban kind of, but we also have stories. We're not totally doing estimates, but it kind of remains to be seen. I'm very skeptical of it. And I've been pretty open with everyone. We've gone through a series of how do we get faster? How do we develop faster? How do we get improve our velocity? And I keep coming back to you can have like reliability or speed or
you can't have it all.
You can't have it all.
So who's actually pushing for the speed?
The exec team, the product team. I mean, it's always there's a lot of competitors out there. We're in a very competitive market space. Some of them are really big. I think there's a lot of pressure to close the gap between us and them. And so we were a pretty big fish in our pond before. And over the course of the year, we've expanded the pond to be huge. And so now I think there's just a lot of, and there's been a little bit of a feeling. And I think a lot of the developers felt it too, of that we should be able to deliver software faster. I mean, I've been doing Scrum ever since I left my first job out of college was not Scrum. It was kind of crazy. But after that, I've been doing Scrum ever since. And I mean, I have to say it's not perfect, but it's at least everyone could look at it and have some idea of what they're getting when. And so from my perspective, it's got a few things. It's on the board. I can drag it and know what I'm working on. I can know what other people are working on. So it works for me. So I've been, I'm pretty flexible on that front, but I'm skeptical as to whether how effective it will really be at one, speeding us up, and two, giving product the visibility and the assurances that they want that will hit our targets.
How would you like to see development practices in Yesware go?
I am a big fan of the process that we currently do with the code reviews and write rigorous tests. I will say that I wonder if we can get a little bit of speed improvement and keep the code review process by having an ability to develop sort of newer features and newer functionality in isolation in a way that we can justify not going through that rigorous process. Because I do think that part of the speed, the time to delivery, is that process. If I can commit to master, I'm going to write code a lot faster. I don't have to ask people's permission if this looks like a good design or anything like that. Just that time of having to go through that, you're just going to be faster. If you can skip writing tests, yeah, it's going to be way less stable. But if all you're doing is trying to get a prototype out so that a product person can show something to a customer that, hey, in 3 months we're going to build this, and maybe it's worthwhile.
What about the hierarchy of the company? How would you like to see that go?
I think, I like the organization we have, the titleists, the everybody's equal. I'd like to see us hold on to that as long as we can. That said, I think that at some point we're going to have to start putting in place, either through formal titles or for formal positions, it might just be through, these group of people are like the people that all they're involved in all major architecture design. And some of these things
they're
we've tried.
Architects,
but not in we have a weekly meeting, and some of these things we've tried and they kind of work. Teams come to the meeting and talk to us and we'll give pointers, but it's less top down and more bottom up. If you don't come ask, there's no walking around saying, you need to talk to us about your design. But at some point it might make sense. I don't know. I the thing I would be most concerned about with that is the feeling of an individual engineer feeling less empowered. I feel like I think about that a lot, how to keep people the most happy, even though it has nothing to do with my job. Just because I remember being that lowly engineer where you had a really great idea, but your boss was like, no, I really want to build it this way. And so we're building it that way. And you're like, well, you haven't looked at any of this code, so you don't even know how it works. And so you think, so the idea that you can take those small victories and, you know, hopefully learn as the process is, seems huge. So, and just having that relationship be more of a mentor, mentee, as opposed to sort of top down. I would really hope that we could keep that, but I know that as we get bigger, it will be increasingly harder. We'll have to work harder at it. So,
any final notes before we wrap up?
No, I would like to thank you for the opportunity to do this podcast and let everyone who's listening know that Yesware is always hiring. You can always visit the Yesware careers page yesware.com/careers to find out what open positions we have. But whatever's listed there, if nothing suits your fancy and you're a, you know, smart, nice person, so, you know,
nice is very important.
Still, yeah. It's very important to be able to work in our environment and be a nice person. We have to get along with each other, and we work very long hours together. So,
right. Justin Mills, thank you very much for your time tonight.
You're welcome. It's been a lot of fun.
The opening music was The Return by Nisi 23 from the album 11 and 12, and the closing music was Like Being in a Bluebell Wood by Tony Higgins from the album Ray, A Life Underwater.